And I'm very happy to introduce you to our panelists today. At my immediate, at far right, and our first speaker is the Honorable Kelly Curry, who is an adjunct senior fellow at the Indo-Pacific Security Program of the Center of New American Security. Ambassador Curry served as U.S. Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues and U.S. Representative of the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. She also served under Ambassador Nikki Haley as United States Representative to the UN Economic and Social Council and Alternative Representative to the General Assembly. Throughout her career in foreign policy, Ambassador Curry has specialized in human rights, political reform, development, and humanitarian issues. She has held senior policy positions with the Department of State, the U.S. Congress, and several international and non-governmental human rights and humanitarian organizations. I also learned that she's a recovering lawyer, having received a Juris Doctor from Georgetown University, but thankfully for her, she's never had to practice. She had an undergraduate degree in political science at University of Georgia School of Public Affairs. Immediately to my right is a second ambassador, Honorable Craig Allen, who's the president of the U.S.-China Business Council. Craig Allen is the president of the council, which is a private, nonpartisan, and nonprofit organization which represents over 200 American companies doing business in China. Craig began his government career in 1985 at the Department of Commerce International Trade Administration. In 1988, he transferred to the American Institute in Taiwan, where he served as director of the American Trade Center in Taipei. He held that position until 1992, when he was named to the Department of Commerce for a three-year posting in Beijing as a commercial attaché. After that, he perfected the trifecta by going to the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, where he served as commercial attaché. He later became Deputy Assistant Secretary for China at the U.S. State Department. He was sworn in as the United States Ambassador to Brunei in 2014. He served until 2018 when he transitioned to the U.S.-China Business Council. Craig received a BA from the University of Michigan and a Master's of Science in Foreign Service from Georgetown. Immediately to my left, and our third speaker, is John Jenkins, who's Executive Vice President and General Counsel of TE Connectivity. John is responsible for the company's global legal compliance, corporate governance, government affairs, intellectual property, security and risk management, and corporate social responsibility. Connectivity, TE Connectivity, he joined in 2012. Prior to joining TE Connectivity, he was with Tyco International for 10 years and was the Vice President, Corporate Security and International General Counsel. Prior to 2003, John worked as a litigator with McGuire Woods and began his career in 1987 as an officer in the United States Navy and served as a judge advocate both in military prosecutor and senior defense counsel. And finally, as legislative counsel to the Secretary of Navy, John earned his law degree from George Washington University here with high honors and bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia. On my far left, and just arrived, Dr. Corey Shockey. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes!
Director of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Shockey leads Foreign and Defense Policy Studies for the AEI. She's the author of Safe Passage of the Transition from British to American Hegemony, and with Jim Mattis, the editor of Warriors and Citizens, American Views on Our Military. Dr. Shockey has taught at Stanford, Johns Hopkins, SIAS, and West Point. She's also a distinguished career in government, working at the U.S. State Department, the U.S. Department of Defense, and National Security Council. With that, we'll start with Ambassador Curry.
Thank you so much, Judge Bea. It's an honor to be here with you today, especially as a non-practicing lawyer and someone who narrowly escaped a former life. And
could you get closer to the microphone?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, absolutely. It's an honor to be with you all here today. I've spent most of my career in public policy, but my training as a lawyer has occasionally served me usefully throughout that 25 years or 20-something years since I graduated from law school. It is an honor to be able to speak with actual practicing lawyers and to have this opportunity to talk to you today about an issue that's about issues that are very close to my heart and things that I care about a lot. The topic of the panel being China, human rights, and global companies, there we could go in a lot of different directions, but I'm going to try to follow a pretty linear story. And it starts in a place in Western China called Xinjiang, and it is the story of an ethnic minority called the Uyghurs. There are other Muslim Turkic ethnic minorities living in Western China, the Kazakh, Uzbek, Kyrgyz, other Turkic peoples who live in this area. This area used to be an independent country briefly called East Turkestan, and today it is one of the largest chunks of China under Chinese control, and is now referred to as Xinjiang, which in Chinese means new territory. It was taken over by the People's Liberation Army after they secured control of the Chinese heartland, and has been a restive area that was not always very well under control, and certainly was not a part of most Chinese empires in a very integrated way throughout Chinese history. So it's an area of China that is culturally quite different from the Han Chinese heartland. The people speak a language that comes from a different linguistic family. They practice Islam, and they are more oriented culturally, ethnically, toward Central Asia, toward the Stans that used to be part of the former Soviet Union. So this part of China, of modern the People's Republic of China, has been a problem from a management standpoint for the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party since they came into power. And at various times they've used various tools and practices to try to bind this region to the People's Republic of China, mostly repressive means, but also some more co-optation and economic integration means and combinations of those tools. But since 2009, when there was a major uprising, a very violent uprising in the capital of this region called Urumqi, the Chinese party state has turned very hard toward repressive measures to try to maintain what they describe as a terrorist threat, or to control what they describe as a terrorist threat in Xinjiang. And in order to do this, they have essentially built a prison state in Xinjiang where forced labor, mass internment, mass incarceration, a panopticon approach to security with mass deployment of CCTV, use of all sorts of facial recognition, even gait recognition technology is commonplace, both inside and outside of the places of detention. The United States government, which I was part of for the past few years, estimated that between 1 and 3 million people have gone through the Chinese mass detention facilities in Xinjiang. The detention is arbitrary. It is not appealable through any judicial process. There is no due process. And the crimes that these people have committed, in most cases pre-crime, if you've ever seen the movie Minority Report, you're familiar with the theory of justice that the Chinese party state is using in Xinjiang, because they essentially put people in detention for thought crimes and for being too piously religious, for being too observantly religious, for having too long or unkept beards, for refusing to eat pork during Chinese festival days, for refusing to drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes or use foul language even, for reading the Quran too much, for praying too much. These are all things that could land you in a Chinese detention facility in Xinjiang. What happens to you once you get into these detention facilities is you are subjected to what's called re-education. And essentially, this is an effort to strip away your ethnic identity as a Turkic Muslim minority and to make you more like a normal Han Chinese person. If that sounds pretty Orwellian, it is. And the methodology is pretty brutal. These places are prisons. Let's be very clear. They have barbed wire around them. They have watchtowers with armed guards. You live in barracks you're given gruel to eat. These are not, you know, schools. These are not training centers as they have been portrayed by the Chinese party state. So this is the context of what led the administration last year, the State Department and Secretary Mike Pompeo to determine, I did forget one very important thing. Outside of the camps, Uyghur women are subjected to extremely harsh and rights violating population control methodologies, including forced sterilization, forced abortion, and other methods of coercive population control. This, in addition to being largely separated from men of child-producing age due to the mass detention. So you have family separation, you also have removal of children from homes. It is literally, they've done just about everything they can to erase Uyghur culture, shutting down mosques, taking children out of homes and putting them in boarding schools where they're taught Chinese and not their own culture or their own language. So this is the context in Xinjiang right now. This really began in earnest in 2016. We started getting reports about it in 2017. The reports intensified, and last year in 2019, the State Department began a process of I was in the Office of Global Criminal Justice at the time, and we began compiling basically a dossier to determine whether crimes against humanity, genocide, or some other form of atrocity was being committed in Xinjiang. And in January, the Secretary of State made a determination based on the evidence that had been collected and compiled and a legal analysis that my friend Nathan Sales over there and I worked on that indicated that we believe that in addition to crimes against humanity, that genocide was being perpetrated against the Uyghur people and other ethnic and religious minorities in Xinjiang by the Chinese Communist Party. With that finding of genocide, we set a new standard in terms of how this situation was viewed by the U.S. government. But even prior to that determination, the State Department, the Department of Commerce, and the Department of Treasury had been moving to sanction individuals and entities that we believed were involved in these crimes and in these gross violations of human rights. That included doing things like putting global Magnitsky sanctions on various individual leaders, and including Chen Guangzhou, who is the head of the party and a Politburo member in Xinjiang, and doing things like issuing withhold release orders on various sectors of the economy where Xinjiang was highly implicated. These included cotton, agricultural products such as tomatoes, and small electronics. This also included labeling or putting certain entities on the commerce entities list. And this included a number of companies that were involved in the mass surveillance and mass intrusive surveillance efforts such as Hikvision, iFlyTech, and others. There are now approximately 30 countries on that commerce entities list. They include companies that are invested, that are being invested in and partners with U.S. companies. They include companies that have a presence in the United States. And they include a number of companies and entities that we are still trying to understand, especially through something called the Bingtuan, the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corporation, which is a quasi-government military thing that is unlike anything else in the world that exists in Xinjiang and owns somewhere between 8,000 and 600,000 subsidiaries or equity stakes in various Chinese entities. So that's the business landscape that's affected by the genocide in Xinjiang. And to date, companies in the United States are trying to figure out how to unwind their exposure to this, what my old boss, Secretary Pompeo, described as the stain of the century, but which I see as a as the mechanization of genocide on a scale that the Third Reich could only have dreamed of doing, and at a technological level that they could only have dreamed of doing. And there is extensive exposure, not only through direct investment and connections, but one of the most interesting areas that I'm currently looking into is the solar panel supply chain, because the vast majority of the solar panel supply chain and the polysilicon that is used to produce photovoltaic cells is produced by China. China has a massive share, in some cases 80 to 90% of the global supply chain in certain elements of solar panels. And they and a lot of that production takes place in Xinjiang. And there are reports, credible reports, of forced labor being implicated in those supply chains. And again, you have major investors, including companies like Invesco, that invest with companies that not only are involved in solar supply chains that may be implicated and problematic with forced labor, but are also in joint ventures that are backed under three or four layers of ownership shells that trace right back to the Bingtuan, which is, again, a sanctioned entity under the Global Magnitsky, which has been put under Global Magnitsky sanctions, and therefore U.S. industry should not be, or U.S. companies should not be doing business with the Bingtuan. So that's kind of a pretty straight line narrative to where we are today, where you have companies that are, I was talking to Ambassador Allen, you have companies that are investing in China, you have companies that are doing business in China, you have companies doing business in the United States that get their supply chains from China, and they are trying, I think most of them in good faith, U.S. companies are trying to understand and remove forced labor from their supply chain. Almost every industry, every solar panel and installer industry in the United States has signed a letter recently saying that they are working to get forced labor out of their supply chain. But one of the challenges is the opaque legal structures that these companies are having to deal with in China. And then one of the other challenges that all investors that are invested in China, whether they're invested in companies that are involved in human rights abuses or not, has to deal with is the fact that Chinese entities, especially those that are listed on the U.S. exchanges that are formed through corporate structures such as the variable interest entities in the Cayman Islands, but have their insiders and their assets primarily in China, are essentially law-proof and regulatory-proof in the United States. And so it's very difficult if you have a problem to get your assets or to extricate yourself, or if the Chinese entity decides to expropriate your investment in them, your capital market investment or whatever, you have very little recourse. So I'll stop there and turn it over with that lovely picture of what's going on, but look forward to your questions about how we as in the legal profession as well as policymakers can start to address some of the serious and inherent risks in this situation, as well from both a moral and philosophical standpoint, as well as how it threatens U.S. competitiveness and threatens to endanger the savings of millions of investors in the United States who are invested without knowing about it in some of these in some of these companies and industries. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Allen.
Okay, well, what a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Judge. Thank you for leading us today, Ambassador. Thank you very much. I have to say, I am not a lawyer, nor a member of the Federalist Society, so please excuse me. I come to here as a career member of the U.S. Foreign Service, served 33 years, much of it in China. So let me start out with a little bit of context. And my first point would be that the U.S. corporate presence in China is indeed very, very large. China is America's largest overseas export market, third behind Canada and Mexico. And more than a million Americans rely on their jobs for exporting to China. And indirectly, multiply that by three, and you get the employment impact of China on the United States. My second point would be that China represents a large percentage of global growth. Over the last 10 years, approximately 30% of global growth, GDP growth, has come from China. And I would anticipate that that will remain the same for the next 10 years. After that, a lowering down. So talk about Asia, of which China is the center. Talk about 40% of global growth. Throw in India, you got 50% of global growth. If American companies are not leaders in China, they are not going to be global leaders. The third point I would make in terms of context is virtually all of our companies are in China for the China market. They are not outsourcing production there to bring back to the United States. They are there because China is an engine of global growth. So now, if one looks dispassionately at the relationship between American companies and human rights in China, I think that you would be very impressed by how many contributions American companies have made over the last 40 years. And indeed, as documentary evidence, if you look at any employment survey in China, you'll find that, or in the most recent surveys, that 6 out of 10 of the best companies to work for young Chinese graduates, are American companies. Now, that's not an accident. It's not because they're human rights violators, and nor is it some historic artifact. It's because they're very good places to work. Now, over the last four decades, American companies have served as an engine of growth and have contributed enormously to to human rights in China, the rule of law, and human dignity in China. So let me just give you a couple of examples, areas, each of which we could write a book on. But worker safety, mine safety, American sanitation, American companies have been the leaders. Anti-corruption and bribery, due to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, American companies are not corrupt. And in China, that is a leading a trait. Gender diversity, elevating women, and respecting LGBT employees. Anti-pollution and responsible manufacturing, workplace safety, and of course, corporate social responsibility. In all of these areas, American companies have shown Chinese companies the way forward, thus contributing enormously to human rights in China. And they are followed by Chinese private sector companies and public sector companies, all of whom are trying to figure out how to do CSR. And they learn from the American corporate model. Simply put, American companies in operating in China follow the rule of law. And if you know China, if you've been to China, you know that that's something that one cannot take for granted in the Chinese market. Now, I'm not here to say that human rights are not a legitimate issue in the discussion of China. China is a huge country, and there are many unresolved tensions, conflicts, and controversies. China has signed and ratified the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and many of these rights are spelled out in the Chinese Constitution. And I think that to the extent that China does not live up to its UN or other multilateral obligations, it's appropriate and useful to remind the Chinese of their formal commitments to these principles and to encourage China to do better to meet its commitments. And in the eyes of this former diplomat, these issues are almost all issues that are properly categorized as multilateral problems. And it's not the United States' sole responsibility to resolve these problems. They are multilateral issues. They affect the global commons. Perhaps we could take the case that Ambassador Curry was speaking on as an example. Chinese law and international practice both prohibit products coming from forced labor from entering into the global supply chain. There is not one U.S. company, certainly not in among the 265 companies in my organization, which knowingly purchases products made of forced labor from anywhere on earth. To do so would be illegal, unethical, and simply unacceptable and bad for business. We agree that suppliers should meet standards set by the International Labor Organization and, of course, our own U.S. Standards and the individual supplier standards of the individual companies, which are almost in every case stricter than ILO or U.S. Corporate standards. Now, I will concur with Ambassador Curry that compliance is not easy. We recognize that recently it's become more difficult for foreign companies to do the due diligence necessary to certify that all their suppliers, especially those that are 3-4 tiers down in the supply chain, to meet these international requirements articulated by the U.S. government and customs. So due to the current difficulty in obtaining reliable factory audits in Xinjiang, the U.S. CBC, has called for the Chinese government to publicly and explicitly ratify the International Labor Organization's conventions on forced labor, and then invite inspectors into Xinjiang to certify that all appropriate ILO standards are being met. And if China wishes to participate in the global supply chains, then China must fully implement the ILO standards and certify that all the factories in the international supply chain meet these standards. So it's my personal view that corporations and all legal persons, you and I, obviously, should respect the human rights and follow the law wherever they are. It's certainly not too much to ask. But it's also my personal view that you're on pretty shaky ground when you require corporations to advance your favored interpretation of human rights, or you penalize them for not going beyond the requirements of the law. And indeed, I think that we could look at our own society and ask those questions of ourselves. In our own country, domestically, the role of corporations and protecting the various rights of individuals and groups is an enormously complex issue on which we have very little consensus. So if we have no consensus internally within our own country, I think that we should be pretty careful when we're addressing other countries. How do we best advance human rights around the world? I think it's through economic integration, having American companies invest robustly, ensuring that we have a level playing field in China, and acting by the rule of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador. And now, Mr. Jenkins.
I think they'll turn it on for you.
Oh, okay. Here. I guess you can hear me. The light's not on, but you can hear me. So good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to give a little bit of a perspective of a company that actually has to operate in this very dynamic global environment. I think as Ambassador Curry, you know, outlined, you know, what are some of the challenges and risks that companies face, and Ambassador Allen outlined, you know, what are the opportunities and benefits before us. A company like TE Connectivity has to navigate and operate in this challenging and sometimes uncertain environment. So maybe a little bit about TE Connectivity. We're a Swiss domiciled, NYSE listed industrial technology company. We do connectivity, terminals, connectors, relays, cables, cable assemblies, components. If you move power, data, or signal through almost any application, chances are it could be our product. We're in every car that's on the planet. We serve every auto manufacturer globally, including the Chinese local OEMs in China, and that's both for internal combustion and for EV. We're in heavy trucks and buses, agricultural equipment. We're in your cell phone, your refrigerator, your television. We're in your desktop computer or your tablet. We're in the medical devices that you have access to in the hospitals. We're on the factory floors that make all of the products that many of us buy and use every day. We're in the energy grid, and we're in home appliances. If your refrigerator is working and telling you that water filtration for your ice maker needs to be changed, it's probably our connector that's moving that signal across that application. We're about $15 billion on the top line, and we're spread very globally, about a third, a third, a third. A third in the Americas, a third in Europe, and a third in Asia, with a heavy concentration in China. Probably about $2.5 billion of our 15 is derived from China economic activity. About 90% of what we design and make and deliver in China is for China consumption, as Ambassador Allen remarked on earlier. We don't export out of China. It's not a low-cost country play for us. It is a very important market, and in a market that will soon probably be the largest economy on the globe. So for a company to be successful, a company needs to be able to compete and navigate in that environment. Got 135 factories around the globe, 17 of which are in China, about 20,000 employees in China, 2,500 engineers that are designing connectivity solutions for our applications, again, across all of those industrial verticals. And we're spread out across the country. We're not in the western part of China, but we are in the Pearl River Delta. We're in Shanghai, Suzhou, Qingdao, you know, Dongguan, Shenzhen, Shunde, where a lot of the manufacturing historically has been. So how does a company like TE, you know, navigate this type of environment where you've got, you know, pressures coming from a variety of sources? Sometimes it's from governmental organizations. Sometimes it's from NGOs. Sometimes it's from your customers. Sometimes it's from employees. Could be your owners telling you what they think you should do. And in many respects, you know, the course you need to steer is one that divorces from external factors that we can't control. We can't control policy. We can't control law. We can't control geopolitical competition. We can't control any of that. But what we can control is ourselves. And so how we, I would say, filter and make decisions around how best to operate and how best to return value to our share owners is by focusing on our stakeholders. And our stakeholders are our customers, our employees, and our owners. And then filtering those stakeholder interests through the company's purpose and the company's values, right? TE's purpose is to build a safer, sustainable, connected, more productive future. And our values, teamwork, innovation, integrity, and accountability. And so we ask ourselves, is a proposed action, is a business course that we are steering, are decisions we are making true to our values and true to our purpose? Is it going to make us you know, able to explain to our employees, our customers, and our owners how and why we have chosen a particular course of action? Is it true to our values? Does it advance our purpose? And at the end of the day, Does it help grow long-term shareholder value? And so I know many of those in the room have a liberal arts background and have heard of a German theoretician, Karl von Clausewitz, his book On War. And, you know, the exercise of national governmental power comes through, you know, four, I would say, main, you know, areas. Diplomacy, and we have diplomats here on the panel with us. Information, governments controlling the narrative, and we see that happening, obviously, around the globe with nationalistic, I would say, developments over the last 3 to 5 years. Military, you know, the use of the military. I mean, war is an inherently a political activity for a political end. And then lastly, economics. And it's that economic geopolitical competition that largely would affect a company like TE. Now, we have to operate in accordance with, you know, the laws and regulations of all of those geographies where we do business, including trade controls. And that would have us respond to, you know, companies or customers being put on the entity list or export controls here in the U.S. At the same time, we have to navigate the countervailing impact of that. The Chinese government has and continues to enact blocking statutes that prevent the enforcement extraterritorially of certain U.S. trade control or U.S. Entity list actions. And so, you know, we can't, again, control that economic competitive dynamic between, you know, the U.S. and China, between the U.S. and EU. But what we can control is, you know, how we react, how we assess and make decisions, our stakeholders, our purpose, our values. And thus far, that has held us, I would say, in very good stead, both with the U.S. government and the U.S. authorities, but also with the Chinese government and the Chinese authorities, where I think, you know, a respected and important partner in both geographies, and, you know, we intend to remain so.
Thank you very much.
So I think the perspective that you just heard from Mr. Jenkins is the perspective that most American businesses, in fact, most international businesses operating in China would prefer, right? Their responsibility is to their shareholders, and their responsibility is to make their product well and make money off of it. The political risk of being able to do that in China is skyrocketing. And whether it remains possible for that to happen, I think it's deeply in doubt. In my judgment, the bifurcation of the global supply chain, international investment, and opportunities to operate businesses is already bifurcating, both by American government policy and by Chinese government policy, and I think it's likely to be irrevocable. So I'm one of those starry-eyed idealists who believed that the United States was right in the early 2000s, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, to invite China into the international order, in the trade regimes, even to give them preferential entry when they didn't yet meet the standards that were governing everybody else. That is, we didn't create a level playing field when we invited China into the international order. We gave them preferential access because we were operating on the belief that another German philosopher, Hegel, purported that is so fundamental to American philosophy, which is that as people grow, as people grow more prosperous, they become more demanding political consumers. And there are a lot of reasons to believe that that's true, right? The countries that are most sustainably prosperous are free societies. Unless you pull diamonds out of the ground or pump oil out of the ground. The relationship between a government and the people it taxes for revenue grows more responsive as people grow more prosperous. China is, of course, the big outlier to that, and has been for at least the last 25 years. Because China is growing more prosperous, it's not growing freer. It's growing much more repressive domestically and much more aggressive internationally. If you doubt this, read the China military report that the Pentagon released last week. Because if you don't lose sleep over that, then I'd love to know what you take to get to sleep at night. As folks said, American businesses operating in China have been forces for prosperity, forces for advancing the rule of law. The problem is that the rule of law in China, for example, now requires companies to give access to Chinese intelligence services to their data. That's not going to be sustainable for American companies, no matter how much you want to operate in China, no matter how much the prosperity of the company depends on access to the China market. It is simply not going to be sustainable, because the two conflicting forces that are driving up geopolitical risk are Western publics who believe that our values are universal, that people have rights, and they loan them to governments in limited ways for agreed purposes. That is not the nature of the bargain in China. That is not the nature of law in China. And the example about China now making it illegal for companies to comply with American sanctions, you can't reconcile those two things. So companies would be judicious to be slowly, gently, in ways that don't alarm the Chinese government before you have your assets out of the country, trying to find a way to initially make production and supply chains more resilient by having alternative sourcing. And then to figure out whether you'd rather be in the dollar-denominated market or whether you'd rather be in the Chinese market. Because my guess is 15 years from now, there won't be any middle ground between the two. There's one last thing, which is that the most interesting test case right now is actually the National Basketball Association, which a couple of years ago, a manager for a not very interesting team made a statement about human rights in China. And the totally disproportionate blowback by the Chinese, which was shutting off access to the NBA in China, so alarmed the leadership of the organization, because they're trying to make money in an emerging market, and they're right to be trying to make money in an emerging market. That became untenable. And so the decision of how to back down without losing your American customers is the problem for businesses. It's already the problem, and Enos Kanter has just dramatically upped the ante by being really strident on social media about Uyghur genocide and about complicity by Western companies in that. This is like, and so China has now blocked his team's games in China, and the next round is now to see whether the NBA capitulates to Chinese pressure. If other players the war is actually a war of individuals making choices in the West and the Chinese government trying to apply broad penalties for it. That's why I think it's unavoidable, and that we may actually get some help from the fact that it looks to the economists at the American Enterprise Institute like our policies are still being driven by the belief that China is stampeding towards prosperity and power. And it looks to our economists like the Chinese economy is now stalling, and we may soon have the problems of a failing China, which actually may be worse than the problems of a succeeding China. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. It's not a privilege of the moderator to ask him questions before I open it up to the panelists. And I have a question for Ambassador Curry. You talked briefly about the Global Magnitsky Act sanctions and enforcement as against individual Chinese or Chinese companies. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So for those of you who don't know, the Global Magnitsky sanctions are named after a gentleman named Sergei Magnitsky, who was a Russian accountant who worked for a man named Bill Browder, who was investing in the Russian economy. And when Sergei discovered that there were some improprieties going on with a company that Mr. Browder was attempting to invest in or do business with, and then started making noise about this, and it implicated some very powerful people in Russia, and Sergei was murdered by these people. And Bill Browder became incensed and obsessed with getting justice for his friend and accountant, Sergei Magnitsky, and ultimately that led to the passage in the Congress of something called the Magnitsky Law, which allowed the United States to put sanctions on individual government officials and entities in Russia that were involved with either corruption or gross violations of human rights. Several years later, that law was expanded globally, and those are the proof standards. It's a law that's administered by the Treasury Department and the State Department jointly, based on an executive order that was issued by President Trump in 2017. And to date, hundreds of individuals and entities have been put on Magnitsky sanctions lists. And the Magnitsky sanction list allows for visa prohibitions and financial sanctions. It denies individuals who are listed on Magnitsky sanctions access to the U.S. global financial system. And as you probably can imagine, if you are denied access or the ability to engage with the U.S. financial system, you are locked out of much of the global financial system. You're not allowed to engage in dollar-denominated trade or other activities that touch on the U.S. banking system. So it's a very powerful tool. And in China, as I mentioned, Chen Guangzhou, who was the party secretary of Xinjiang at the time, Zhu Hailin, who was the head of the he's the party secretary, the political commissar of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and several other individuals involved in repression in Xinjiang were put on the list, and then the Bingtuan as an entity was put on the list, and the Chinese Public Security the Xinjiang Public Security Bureau was also listed. It's primarily used to target government officials, but can also be used to target others as well.
Okay. A question for you, Ambassador Allen. You mentioned the ILO conventions regarding worker conditions and also forced labor. Is there any tool for enforcing compliance upon the Chinese government in that area?
So in the Chinese negotiations with the Europeans, the EU, on the Comprehensive Agreement on Investment, the Chinese did pledge that they would respect the ILO conventions. That agreement has not gone into force, but it's indicative, I think, of potentially getting to a place where the ILO conventions are respected. The Europeans have walked away from that agreement. Currently, it is very difficult, and I would say impossible, to get certification that Chinese factories in Xinjiang are following the regulations. So unless there are independent auditors and inspectors to certify that a factory is not using forced labor, then it's hard to prove that they're not. U.S. law, I think, is changing. The Xinjiang Forced Labor Prevention Act, which is currently probably near completion, is probably going to pass. Absent of labor inspections and certifications, I don't know how you do it.
Okay, thanks very much. As a judge and a recovering lawyer, I'm interested in the rule of law as it applies, and particularly because of one of our judges who's traveled very often in China, Judge Wallace, I'd like to ask Mr. Jenkins, on the commercial level of commercial disputes, can you describe how the Chinese courts work and whether arbitration is a system which has entered into Chinese commercial disputes as it has in this country?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it's certainly been our experience, given, as I mentioned, where we operate, you know, Eastern China from, you know, Qingdao through down through Suzhou and into Shanghai, and in Southern China around the Pearl River Delta, that the Chinese courts, and particularly the commercial courts and those that handle intellectual property, do render, you know, principled decisions based on the evidence. And we do have, I think, experience where we believe that the decisions that have been rendered in cases where we've had those types of disputes, you know, has been just based on the facts and based on the evidence, and it's not been influenced by, you know, either, you know, politics or, you know, forces external to the courtroom itself. You know, we don't think that we got home cooked. One particular, you know, dispute comes to mind where, you know, a trademark dispute between, you know, TE and a local Chinese company in Shenzhen. You know, the dispute was litigated over 5 years. We won at each instance in the Chinese court system, and ultimately, you know, the property rights of a, you know, in this case, Western multinational, you know, won out over a, you know, a local businessman, you know, asserting a, you know, a contract right. And so we find that the court system, you know, at least in those jurisdictions where we're, you know, I would say heavily present, are reliable for resolving commercial disputes. That said, you know, depending on what area of law you're talking about, it's a little bit of a different legal regime. You know, I mean, the Chinese labor and employment legal regime is very employee friendly. And I think I find in those cases, you know, courts will be very accommodating to an employee who is, you know, challenging a labor action, probably for, you know, I would say more socialistic reasons than based on the, you know, the principles of the case.
Sounds like California.
or South Korea or Japan or a number of other, I would say, pro-employee jurisdictions. But we know that. And, you know, that's, I would say, somewhat a cost of, you know, of doing business in that country. So I would say, by and large, you know, find that the court system works as it's, I would say, you know, intended to, and don't find the need to resort to alternative dispute measures to resolve commercial disputes.
Judge, I'm sorry, if I can just add one thing, though, because I think it's very important, that as long as your case doesn't touch on the party's prerogatives or the political interests of the party, then you're generally going to get, you know, the result and the outcome and the process that my fellow panel member describes. But if you do in any way impinge on the party's prerogatives or anything, any political subject, that, and this is true not just of American or Western companies, but true of Chinese defendants as well, and that the party does consider the law and the courts a tool of the party, and everything about the law and the courts are subservient at the end of the day. And this is in the Constitution, the Chinese Constitution, that at the end of the day, everything is subservient to the party. And if the party decides that they want an outcome, then that's the outcome that the courts come up with. And this has been, you know, this has been proven time and time again.
Now, a question for Dr. Shaki. You mentioned a military analysis which should keep us awake at night. To what extent is the military analysis going to affect business in China?
Oh, that's a great question, Your Honor. I think the tension between China's dramatic military expansion and what it is they're trying to do with it is making Washington policy nervous, right? I mean, the members of Congress are falling over each other to be tougher on China. There's not a let's be cautious, they might not mean this, caucus on China these days, because they are expanding their military. They tripled the size of their nuclear force, for example, which is causing the Pentagon to worry that they had always assumed that China's nuclear deterrent had a minimalist strategy, namely just to deter an attack on the country of China. And they have a force capable of that, and they just tripled it. And they just tested hypersonic missiles that can orbit the Earth and thereby get past any missile defenses that the United States or other countries might construct. So they just did targeting exercises where the targets were American aircraft carrier mock-ups. And so the military ambitions China... Oh, I'm sorry, one last piece I should have added, which is their real aggressiveness against their neighbors is causing us to think that all that military buildup is for a purpose. And that is contributing to a reevaluation of what it is the Chinese government wants. And that assessment of what the Chinese government wants is part of this spiraling up of political risk that's going on and that will inevitably affect the business climate.
Has it, to date, decreased American investment in China?
You know, it's so interesting. It has not, but what we are seeing is the starting of the conversation about it, right? Ray Dalio, Wall Street and Silicon Valley are the interesting bellwethers on this. Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater, an enormous investment firm, argues that there's no telling who will win the war between the U.S. and China. Therefore, he's investing equally in both countries. But, you know, the state of California is refusing to allow its retirement funds to invest in Chinese-owned companies. So you start to see the conversation. George Soros took to the pages of the Wall Street Journal to argue that it's un-American to invest in Chinese companies. The Commerce Department begins to get a lot more aggressive about determining what areas of the Chinese economy that need to be off limits to American investors and what areas of the American economy they will not permit Chinese to invest in. So the bifurcation is just starting, and the area most resistant to it is Wall Street.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like to open up the panel to ask questions one of the other.
Can I just say another area that is a little bit resistant is American farmers. So 30% of soybean exports go to China. The U.S. agricultural community is prices are high now. And a lot of that is as a result of China. So it's not only Wall Street many American citizens like you and me who are making a living as a result of a rapidly growing economy that has a complementarity about it. And so projecting forward and suggesting that it's all going to go unravel, the evidence indicates otherwise. Thank you.
Now, do any of the panel members wish to add to their remarks or ask questions of each other?
I mean, there are a couple things that I could add to onto what Corey has said about some of this, and I, you know, it was very interesting when I was listening to the comments and saying that, you know, that this is that these issues need to be handled through a bilateral, that human rights are something that need to be handled through bilateral mechanisms, and they certainly are being handled through bilateral mechanisms such as the UN Human Rights Council, where China is a member in good standing, along with Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and Saudi Arabia. So that's super awesome. And you've also discussed how the International Labor Organization basically has no access to do any kind of auditing or labor monitoring in China when it comes to issues like forced labor. And I would add that third-party auditors have basically stopped working in China because they can no longer verify supply chains or conduct credible audits. But one thing that just kept coming back to me is this quote that I heard recently. And I'll read it for everybody, that in addition to addressing workforce needs and expectations, we expect companies to mitigate adverse impacts to people that could arise from their business practices, exposing them to material risks. Failure to address these risks can reverberate across a company's value chain, which may affect critical relationships with key stakeholders and impact shareholder value. Specifically, we ask that companies put in place the appropriate board oversight, due diligence processes, e.g. human rights risk assessment, and supply chain tracing, recruitment procedures, auditing and grievance mechanisms, et cetera, and remediation efforts, and communicate externally on their performance. The person who said that is a gentleman named Larry Fink. He is the CEO of BlackRock, which is an investment firm, I believe, that has $10 trillion in assets under management, primarily U.S. Investors, pension funds, and retirement savings. So I just wanted to point out that Larry Fink thinks that human rights are a valid subject for business people to be engaged on.
Thank you. Now, we'll take questions from the audience. Please state your name and where you're from and to whom you are directing the question.
Great. Thank you. My name is Jonathan Brightbill from Winston & Strawn. And before I start, Judge Bay, it's an honor to be before you again. You were actually on an en banc panel that I argued about 2 years ago. You were one of only two votes that properly held that the court had no jurisdiction and should have dismissed it entirely. So I thank you for that.
People often come up to me at cocktail parties and say, we love your opinions. And I say, that's a case of mistaken identity. I only write dissents.
Well, this one was. So my question is for the panel as a whole. So there's been a reference made to the thesis behind opening the doors to China was that by bringing in American investment, that they would ultimately become a democratic country. And people point to precedents like Japan or South Korea or Taiwan or things that kind of opened up over time. Or at least that was one of the precedents that some people argued, right? Is there a selection bias that there are actually, and I don't know, are there precedents for countries where we opened up the doors and there was a lot of Western investment and we thought that this would lead to ultimately a sustainable democracy, and yet after maybe 10 or 15 years of success, it actually all came crashing down and back. I mean, I think about South America, I think about the Middle East. Seems to me that that's probably true, but I just wonder if, you know, this idea that China, maybe we thought it would work, but it's not going to, if there are actually precedents for that.
So the best counterexample is Imperial Japan, which at the end of the 19th century opened up to cultural, business, political influence, became intertwined, and became more deeply militaristic and dangerous to everyone around it. The highest, the zenith of globalization economically before the 1990s was right before World War I. And so there are good counterexamples, a couple of them. It was more an article of faith and philosophy that we believed that as countries became more prosperous, they would become more politically liberal. There are, because when you look at the countries that are most stable, most prosperous, they are representative democracies. And so, yes, there was selection bias in that article of faith that all of us are now wringing our hands over.
And I would add, because I was working on the Hill during the MFN debate in the mid-90s and working for a member of Congress who was really conflicted and went back and forth on this issue and voted on the most favored nation trading status differently year after year just based on how things were going on the ground in China. And he was convinced of that. I think that the bias was reinforced after the fall of the Soviet Union because we had won the Cold War and our values had triumphed. And I think that did kind of, that end of history argument moment, that Pax Americana moment, kind of convinced us all that this was an inexorable outcome. Because I certainly was guilty of believing it at least a little bit, or hoping, maybe wishful thinking is more the
Can I
proper characterization.
One more quick thing to that, which is the two people who absolutely believe that Hegel was right, and that as people become more prosperous, they become more demanding political consumers, are Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. The repressiveness they are putting into place is precisely because they think our values are universal. And so their two votes matter.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hi there, Connor Curry from Wake Forest University School of Law. I appreciate Ambassador Curry's Scots-Irish spelling of the name. None of this
name.
Why business. My question is, what is the role of the U.S.'s relationship to India in addressing some of these concerns, whether economic or military, with China? And for the panelists, I guess, who are less concerned about China economically and militarily, what does the relationship with India mean for you all?
Corey, that's your wheelhouse.
I'll take the India piece of it, which is the United States has wanted for a long time a lot closer relationship in security and foreign policy with India, and India was never willing to give it, always valuing a sense of itself as the leader of the non-aligned movement. China's behavior is driving India into deep cooperation, not just with the United States, but also with Australia, Japan, other countries. You see the quadrilateral cooperation, not just on security, but on vaccine distribution. The Indians are so nervous about Chinese aggressiveness that they are willing to step away from their traditional non-alignment because they want the help of other countries. It would be fabulous if we could substitute India as a production base, but the problem is bureaucracy in India is so expensive and so unreliable that until they fix that problem, American companies are going to be looking other places.
I can certainly speak, I guess, firsthand on that. Our India business is about the 10th the size of our China business. And as much as we want to invest and grow in the India market, where I only have, four factories in India versus 17 in China, it is that very reason that Western multinationals are not more heavily present and invested in growing India for India. The bureaucracy, the inflexibility, the limitations on FDI, all discourage
the growth of Western multinational presence in India. If you're not one of the 27 families, essentially, largely the Indian economy is closed to you.
Okay. Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. So, Nick Matich, the Chinese Communist Party has probably murdered more people than any entity in human history. And so for the panel, does there become a point where companies should cease doing business in a jurisdiction because its government is so reprehensible? And if so, why is China not that example?
I can't, hard to argue with that, and I think that the fact that they are in the midst of committing a genocide at this very moment is part of that as well. And I think that everybody should be questioning their exposure. I think, though, unfortunately, that most corporate entities, most of the investment firms. I mean, I read that quote from Larry Fink earlier. Larry Fink has also, in the past year, urged all stock indices to reweight toward China, saying that they have China underweighted in their indices by up to a third. He has just opened a massive new retail investment business in China as well. So there's a lot of hypocrisy in business. I'm here to tell you, it's shocking news, I know, especially when it comes to things like the environmental, social, and governance standards that many corporations are signing up to and saying that they espouse as part of the effort to stave off the woke mob. They are espousing all of these new standards for themselves and saying that they believe in saving the planet and reducing carbon and that they respect worker and human rights. It only seems to apply here in the United States, not to overseas jurisdictions, and definitely not to their China business. So I think that one of the big challenges for people who do care about this is to expose that hypocrisy and then monetize it or commoditize it and use it to highlight the problem of how, and it starts with looking at your own investment portfolio, to see what holdings you have in your 401k that may be connected to forced labor supply chains or may be involved or may be supporting companies that are involved with civ mil fusion that are helping Chinese military modernization and the very aggressive and enabling the aggressive behavior that Corey mentioned earlier, the threatening behavior towards China's neighbors and all of these other things. Again, as Xi Jinping continues to assert the party's primacy within China and in some cases take China backwards, both economically and politically, away from the openness of the Deng era. And you see this going on already in the sixth plenum that's taking place right now in Beijing, where Xi Jinping is putting out new pronouncements on what's called common prosperity that's intended to re-level the playing field in China as he's cracked down on high-flying Chinese entrepreneurs to bring them back down to earth, the disappearance of people like Jack Ma, the pullback on the Ant Financial IPO, the pullback, what happened with the Didi IPO, all of these things that are going on. They are, I think, starting to create nervousness within the financial sector about the risk. And what's interesting to me, again, is you're starting to see, you have George Soros on the one hand as criticizing Ray Dalio for his pro-Chinese investment approach, and then you have, on the other hand, people like Josh Hawley and people in the United States and leading Republicans criticizing U.S. companies for basically funding China's military modernization. And it's coming at this from all directions. And so I think when Corey talks about the decoupling and the unsustainability of the present model, those are the warning signs that I see in the system. And whether we're headed toward a situation where the fact that there's $1 trillion in U.S. Investment in Chinese companies that are listed on New York Stock Exchange but incorporated in the Cayman Islands and all of their assets and insiders are inside China, that's $1 trillion in U.S., again, 401k, pension funds, investments that are subject to no legal regime, no regulatory regime, definitely not the SEC, definitely not suable in U.S. courts or assets recoverable by U.S. investors if something were to be expropriated, as happened with Alibaba and Alipay a decade ago. And the fact that these things continue to be, these companies, these Chinese companies, continue to be law-proof, we continue to invest billions, up to $1 trillion in them in through U.S. capital markets, I believe that we are headed toward a situation of systemic risk with that alone, let alone, you know, even if so, what the financial business understands, they don't care about human rights at the end of the day, notwithstanding what Larry Fink says in his ESG letters. They care about money, and they care about making money, and they're chasing alpha, but they do care about risk.
So when I became an ambassador, you get a letter saying that you should be pragmatic and principled. You should follow U.S. government interests in a pragmatic and principled manner. And I think that that's good advice. When you look at China, it's approximately 20% of the global population, about 30% of global growth. Let's do a counterfactual. If you pulled out of China, they're going to have the speed and the scale to dominate the global economy. Now, if we're in there competing with them, we will have working with our allies and trying to, in a very practical manner, the ways that I suggested, trying to improve the situation. That's a pragmatic and principled approach to this. China, you might wish it away. Good luck. It's not going anywhere. We're going to have to work with them. How do we work with them effectively is a question. And I think that talking with them is a good way to go. A little bit of cognitive empathy won't kill you. We need a pragmatic and principled relationship, a stability within this relationship. The discussion of removing American companies will create tremendous instability within the global framework, and it will allow China to dominate East Asia and perhaps the world. And that is not an outcome that any of us should wish for. Thank you.
I have to remind everybody, though, that China gets a vote here, too. It's not just what we do. Xi Jinping gets a vote in this. And so far, he is signaling very, very clearly that he would like to be less reliant on U.S. capital markets for Chinese growth. He would like to be less reliant on U.S. consumers for Chinese growth. They have a theory of dual circulation that they will continue to get what they can from the global financial system and the world economy, while increasing China's own self-reliance on its own internal markets and its own internal capabilities. So, and I'm not making this stuff up. This isn't Kelly Curry's version of what's going on in China. This is what the Chinese Communist Party says itself. I choose to believe that what they say they intend to do is what they want to do.
Okay, next question.
Yes, I'm Sam Wright. I'm an attorney in Central Texas. I understand the PRC clearly has the military capability to invade, defeat Taiwan, but they would take massive casualties. And because of the only recently rescinded one-child policy, it would just be a demographic disaster, and maybe the grieving parents would rise up. Is that a theory that you give credence to, or that Xi Jinping just doesn't care?
I do give some credence to it. You know, China's demographics are one of the reasons not to bet on long-term Chinese power. And if you think about the way, for example, the United States overcomes its demographic constraints, we do it by immigration. And the Chinese don't have a social and economic model that makes that a comfortable alternative for them. So yeah, if you got to choose whether you were going to go into military service, your parents might prevent you from doing so. But don't forget that Chinese have a very limited range of choice. And that the government, if the government chooses to do that anyway, the fact that the Chinese people don't like it probably won't matter. You know, we shouldn't project onto Chinese society the ability to control their government's choices, because sadly they don't have it.
Next question.
Yes, sir. I wanted to say, I think my friend Nicholas has plenty of cognitive empathy. It just happens to be for the Uyghurs.
well said.
But I just, and this, I don't mean to be a snarky question, but I was wondering for Ambassador Allen, thank you for being here. Is there a red line that you think if China crossed, we would have a moral or ethical responsibility to decouple our economy from theirs?
I think that certainly if there was an invasion of Taiwan, that would absolutely be the case. So yeah, of course. I mean, it's not my job to apologize for the Chinese government. It's my job to stand up for American farmers, workers, and ranchers. China is going to continue to produce a lot of growth. Okay. We should be a part of that. American workers, farmers, and ranchers should not be constrained unnecessarily by their government just because of due to sensitivities that are not inherently bilateral. So an invasion of Taiwan, an invasion of Korea, an attack against Japan, closing off the South China Sea, An invasion of India, I agree, that's a very dangerous situation. These are all potentially cause belli.
But they are closing off the South China Sea, they have actually invaded India and taken a swath of territory.
I'm sorry, that is incorrect.
Hi, my name is Ethan Yang. I'm with the American Institute for Economic Research. I'm also 1L at Scalia Law School. My family's also from Taiwan, so I guess fun fact. So on the issue of decoupling, some of it being natural, some of it being due to regulatory issues in the U.S. and China, I'm curious to know, especially given the concerns that Ambassador Allen and Curry raised about the dual circulation on the one hand, but also the ability to retaliate if they invaded Taiwan or South Korea economically on the other. What do you make of the argument that the counterfactual of a decoupled China is much worse than the reality that we have today, as in you will have a CCP that is not concerned with appeasing the U.S. corporations and attracting investment, just concerned with doing its own thing, without the possible threat of actual real decoupling, as in the case of invasion of Taiwan or South Korea, or other human rights violations and that kind of sort. So I was just wondering what the panel thinks of the counterfactual that the CCP will be far more unhinged and far less concerned of treading lightly if we actually fully decouple. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we honestly don't know the answer, right? I think it is generally true that a desire to preserve the engines of prosperity limits the range of choice for most countries. But I'm hesitant to bet too much on it because, for example, Xi Jinping promised President Obama that China was not militarizing the islands it's building in the South China Sea to foreclose other countries' access to it, and yet they have done that. A whole bunch of other ways, China looks to be playing chicken with us, trying to keep their options open while foreclosing ours. And we need to play as aggressive a game as they are if we are to sustain a level playing field, a set of rules that apply not just to us, but also to China.
And I would add to what Corey said that the way that we do that is not by getting in a race to the bottom with China, whether it's economic, political, or otherwise, that we do it by leaning into our own strengths and the areas where they are poorly set up to compete against us. And that's one of the reasons why I think that the effort to work with allies, the Quad efforts such as that, are very important because we do have allies and we do have more a more attractive governance and values model than one-party authoritarianism. And so I think that those are the areas where we as a country can also lean in and really crowd into that space. I think also economic openness. I am a free trader, actually. I believe in free trade. I believe in free trade with free nations, though. I think that if you're trading with unfree nations, you're not dealing with a partner on the other side of the table that's able to come to you and make trade arrangements that are equitable. They just can't because they have different incentive structures within their governance and they have different incentive structures for their own political survival. So I think it's really important to make that caveat on what free trade looks like, that it has to be done with partners that come to the table with the same expectations that you do.
Next question.
Thank you. Robert Delaney, I'm the North America Bureau Chief with South China Morning Post. I just wanted to ask, with respect to the challenges that U.S. companies have with China, when it comes to supply chains and when it comes to technology, to what extent will the Innovation and Competition Act that's been passed by the Senate have, assuming that the House passes their version and it becomes law, to what extent does this legislation, if it becomes law, will it help U.S. companies? Thank you.
Want to take that, Johnny?
Sure. most companies, at least, in the technology and manufacturing space that TE is in, we design local for local, we make local for local, and we deliver local for local. Companies that would be, in that supply chain for the industrial supply chain, be it OEMs, tier ones, tier twos, the way that they're organized is they want their supply chains, relatively speaking, close to where they are, and innovating, making, and delivering close to where they are. And so, as I mentioned at the outset, we're roughly a third, a third, a third across the globe. And our engineering power is split roughly along those lines as well. And so our engineers are designing in Shanghai, or they're designing in Bangalore, or they're designing in Bensheim, Germany, or just up the road in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for applications that are going to be made locally, drawing local supply chain raw materials and delivered locally to the customer where they need it for their application. And so, much of the, I would say export control and technology control efforts, don't reach a broad swath of what industrial tech actually does on a day-to-day basis. We're a Swiss domiciled company where, engineering operations, outside of the U.S. Are, I would say, largely, outside of the legislative reach of, the U.S. or the U.K. or Germany, or you pick the country where there's regulatory activity. But as long as you're design, making, and building locally, you're a domestic enterprise for the purposes of whatever, again, technology or trade control, law you're talking about. So we, of course, are paying attention and want to understand, the reach, the scope, the limitations. But fundamentally, we organize, design, make, and deliver, at a local level. And as long as that's the business model that our customers, who's one of our important stakeholders, right, expects of us, that's how we're gonna behave, because that's how we compete.
That's a nice point.
All right, we have 5 minutes left. Next two questions, you first.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Aaron Katz, University of Connecticut School of Law. It's been said that America's companies have been bringing rule of law, justice, and liberty to the communists. And I am wondering if there is any concern that the opposite ideals, the ideals of China's authoritarian regime, have been rubbing off on us. Are we bringing back their toxic ideas to the American people and our institutions, or is it only a one-way street?
That's a fabulous question. I don't see much evidence that American businesses are adopting Chinese Communist Party practices, in part because American law prevents it, right? You don't have the ability to do things that the Chinese government can do and can make possible in China. So the rule of law matters hugely. Congress would sanction it, state governments. You have so many more means of legal, political, and societal control over activity in the United States that I don't think it's much of a threat. But the point you raise is an interesting one. So I was having a debate with a terrific China scholar, Nadege Roland, from the National Bureau of Asian Economic Research. And I was arguing that the activism of American civil society groups, basketball players caring about Uyghur rights, is actually going to either drive bifurcation or drive changes in Chinese government behavior. And she thinks I'm mistaken, because she thinks the Chinese government has already written off Western markets and Western publics as unwinnable in the medium term, but that what China's doing is focusing on winning the global South. Countries where you have 27 families who run the economy or authoritarian states, that is, we may be unwinnable, but there's a huge swath of the world that's in play, because our values are disruptive to the social and political and economic orders.
I come down somewhere in between my good friend Nadege and Corey on this, that I think that yes, China is pivoting toward dealing with the global South because it's much easier, and they're swimming in a warm sea when they're dealing in countries that have weaker rule of law, weaker institutions, weaker oversight mechanisms than the United States. But when it comes to U.S. and you know, not just U.S. business, but when it comes to the global kind of multinational corporations, to the U.S. financial services industry, they are still very much interested in co-opting and instrumentalizing that those sectors and continuing to try to use them to advance their purposes, whether it's to get access to advanced technology, get access to liquid capital markets. We still have the most liquid, most largest by a factor capital markets in the world, and they still do need some of that, and that's why you've seen after, you know, a couple, some pretty dramatic things with the Ant Financial IPO and the DD IPO, that there was a big effort by the Chinese Communist Party to reassure the financial elites and the global business elites that no, we still want your money, we still want your investment, please BlackRock come open your retail investment operation here and set up a $1 billion mutual fund and let Chinese invest in it directly. So they're still hedging a little bit, definitely moving towards the global South, but still see these sectors, the U.S. business community in particular, as a valuable ally in holding off the decoupling movement and the more hawkish elements of U.S. National security and foreign policy and trade policy.
Last question.
Thank you, Judge, and thank you all for really a fantastic panel. And I'll keep this short. I know we're running out of time. Mr. Jenkins, I was really intrigued by your comments about Chinese courts. In my experience and in my practice, Harut Samra with DLA Piper, one of the concerns that remains prevalent is intellectual property protection. And we are, and I've been involved in arbitrations and other disputes with Chinese companies. What, if you can expand a little bit on your experience with the Chinese courts, but in particular, if you could talk about under what circumstances you might look or have looked to international arbitration, for example, as an alternative, and to what extent you have had a positive or other experience with that as it relates to your business interactions in China. Thank you.
Sure. So without boring you, I guess, with facts and figures and details, right? We're a Clarivate top 100 innovator. We have about 14,000 patents and are consistently innovating largely electrical, mechanical, and material science solutions.
Now, not all those solutions are, I would say, fit for a global market or global purpose. A lot of those are, I would say, regionally designed, right? I don't need to over-engineer because I can't sell and make margin if I'm over-engineered. I need to engineer fit for purpose and then, you know, make for margin, so to speak. So, you know, in large part, again, you know, the local designs, manufacturing, and applications drive your IP strategy. I don't need to protect a piece of IP that I develop in India or Germany or the US. I don't need to protect it everywhere because it's not necessarily fit for purpose everywhere. However, where it is fit for purpose everywhere, there are those types of, you know, innovations that are truly breakthrough in, you know, material science or whatever the engineering application is. Well, then we will look to, I would say, you know, protect and license in a manner that gives us the highest degree of comfort and confidence that our innovation is, you know, number one, going to be protected, and number two, is not going to be subject to inappropriate exploitation, use, or copying. And, you know, in those circumstances, we would, you know, I would say, you know, have a more Western protection regime. I will say, however, that, you know, we have found, you know, particularly in China, you know, the willingness of competition authorities to respect and enforce intellectual property rights. I've had, during my tenure as general counsel, no more than four, right, customs raids for counterfeit, you know, factory activities where, you know, you're taking my design, you're copying it, you're using my trademarks, you're selling to, you know, my customers, you know, Western OEMs, you're selling, you know, a connector to Volkswagen representing that it's mine, and in fact, it's not mine. And the competition police, you know, when we present them with the evidence, you got to sort of make the case, but then, you know, they'll go in, they'll seize the goods, they'll arrest the people, and, you know, they will make them accountable to us financially for, you know, the harm they've caused. So, you know, kind of 80-20 rule, maybe, you know, 80% of it, you know, local protections and a local IP strategy is sufficient. 20% would maybe be a little bit more of a breakthrough innovation that you would treat a little bit differently, you know.
Okay. Hope that helps. All right. Now, before we thank our panel, I'd like to remind you that the next event will be the Barbara K. Olson Memorial Lecture and reception starting at 5 p.m. in the Grand Ballroom. Now, can you join me in all thanking our panelists?